accession number 18779, Reel 2.
Bill Pickard, Reel 2.
Anyway, he'd told me I could borrow any book from the library, and I was in there one day browsing around, and I came across the book by this author, Evans Wentz, which I just glanced into, and it was a book known as the Bada Thodol, which was the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and apparently it was fairly rare at that time, before the war, and only sort of specialists had it. It is now, I gather, quite well known, and the young have all been delving into it and so on. And a voice over my shoulder said, "Are you interested in that?" And it was my host. And I said, well, I'd explain how I'd come across in London, and I got rather interested in Zen and their approach to life and things. And he said, and I mentioned meditation, that I had thought it would be something I would like to have known more about. But how did you find out? And he said, would you like to meet a meditation teacher? He said, he's a Tibetan. And a lama, as a matter of fact. And of course, at that time, I had not long before read Hilton's Lost Horizon. So I had some, and also somebody else, French woman, who wrote about her travels in Tibet in the last century, I think it was. And I had a very picturesque image of magical lamas in Tibet floating around on magic carpets and things like this. So I think it must have been all rather naive and childish. But anyway, I was introduced to this lama who used to come down, Lama Sinking. I can't remember his full name now. Anyway, apparently was quite a well-known lama as a meditation teacher, and he'd been a pupil of a famous Chinese patriarch who had was also in this sect that I think in China is known as Chan, and became Zen in Japan. And Xu, I think is his name, but I can't be sure. Anyway, he died quite comparatively recently after the communist had taken over in China. He apparently was revered sufficiently by Mao Zedong to for him not to destroy or damage the monasteries at that time. But as soon as the old patriarch died, of course, he then clamped down on them. But this lama I met had been a pupil of his, and it was to lead to quite a string of things. And I later on, my wife and I were instrumental in helping the first Tibetans that were sent over here after the war. One of them started the Lamasery up in Scotland, now at Sami Ling, and the other one went to America, Drungpa, where he died recently. I'm not sure that his efforts were quite so successful there in a spiritual sense, though it became quite an affluent group with a lot of young Americans belonging to it, but I think it's got rather a bad name. But anyway, that's quite beside the point. While I was in India, I attended, and he got me interested in meditation. And when I was, I had to go back to East Africa, because I was with the East African division that had gone across to Burma, and I'd been stationed with the KR, and so I had to go back there to finish my army time after independence, after 47, and then I was, I went into the British military mission in Ethiopia, so I was up there. So I didn't come out when the war finally ended. I stayed on until the end of the beginning of 47, it would be, yes, or the end of 46. And that's when I was finally sent back here. Not knowing what I was going to do, one mad scheme was to go out and join the Lama up in Darjeeling and go and retire to a cave in the mountains somewhere and be a hermit. And I think he quite wisely put a Scot. He laughed when I said, this, would he welcome me, or would it be possible if I came back there? And he told me that he thought that I would find what I was looking for in the West and not to think of coming back to India. Well, of course, in the interim, politically everything changed. It was the independence the following year, and it wouldn't have been easy to come back and do this sort of thing. Though I know later on, quite a lot of young people did do that, go to India and join these various groups and so on.
Could I just bring you back to Joe Beckett?
Yes.
Because how did you find him? How did you come into contact with him in the first
place? At work. I came into contact with him at work. We were working for this building firm, and the owner, I suppose, of the firm, somebody called Ivy, he had a number of properties in the East End, and this is which I thought in pretty poor condition, really, which he obviously let out. That was one side. The other side of his business was doing up offices and places like that. So we did quite a lot of work where we would go in the evening and work through the night, and we had to clear all our mess by morning and all this sort of thing, because they would be in use again the following day. So I did quite a number of jobs like that in the year before. That would have been 34, 35, 36, I suppose.
And it sounds as though Joe Beckett was rather circumspect about his commitment to the Communist Party.
Yes, he was. We just didn't really talk about it. He obviously just pushed odd things in my way. He was a very nice person. I liked him very much. He told me an awful lot about the conditions of the First World War, and we talked about the appalling conditions of the working people in England and so on. And I only attended a few of these meetings. My other feeling was that fascism was rising in Europe. I could see that. It seemed that country after country was sort of being taken over by different fascists, and Hitler was advancing everywhere, and we seemed to be giving way always to him, you know. So at that time, it seemed very much that if we could only stop him in Spain, here was a government that had been elected freely by the people. I knew, and I had a kind of emotional feeling also, which I think was supported when I got to Spain, and that was that the church always seemed to come out quite well wherever it was in a Catholic country. And though it did quite a lot of good, I can remember in Lima, for instance, where the nuns had a system of a funny sort of tripod thing, not a tripod, but a V-shaped drawer that fixed in the door of the nunnery place, and the girls who produced illegitimate babies and couldn't keep them, or it was going to be scandal, I think, used to put the baby in there, push the door up, and nuns used to adopt the child and teach them a trade and so on. And quite a lot of these babies were girls, because they wanted a boy, because he could start early and go out and earn money in the poor areas of Lima and Callao and places like that. But a girl was going to be more of a liability. And so I'm afraid they used to get rid of the babies that way. But there's a lot of these things sort of gave me a sort of feeling, I suppose, for them.
But you said you didn't join the Communist Party.
No.
But did you join anything at all?
No, I didn't even join in an official sense the Labour Party, no. I would just call myself a socialist, and I went wrong. Nobody ever sort of queried the matter, and attended the odd meetings and so on. And finally...
Did you attend the meetings of Labour Party?
Yes, in the halls. I mean, nothing to do. I didn't work for them. I know they tried once or twice at odd council elections or something to get one to do odd jobs. But no, I don't think I ever felt enough to be involved. And it suddenly began to gel, I think, in 36, when there was the uprising, of course, first. And then, whereas most people weren't very interested in it because it was Spain, and I suppose I paid a little bit more attention to it. I realised that the army, Franco, had come across and started this insurrection against the government and so on. And when Joe and I used to talk, and another chap called Bob Ivey, who's a distant relation of the boss, who also I suspect was a member of the Communist Party, but certainly he was a Labour supporter. They used to get quite heated about it, and our government and the French government at that time seemed to be completely oblivious to anything, and were always pussyfooting whatever Hitler or Mussolini, came up with anything. We mustn't offend them. We must do this and so on. And so when finally this said, I think it was towards the end of 36, we heard that one or two Brits had gone over there. What's his name? The poet.
Cordwell?
No, not Cordwell. Yes, I know. Yes, I know him. But the one who got killed. Early on, 36, end of 36, Darwin's nephew.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter, it doesn't matter.
What's his name? This is what...
Julian Bell?
No, Julian not Julian Bell. Bell, no. Anyway, strangely enough, years later, I met his cousin, because she came and lived in the village down here. And she asked me about how he came to die. So I said I wanted to go. And Joe then, I think, said, are you quite sure about this? And I think he was probably thinking more about, the effect on my mother, because she'd lost my father through the war, and there was I got a brother who was coming along, younger than me, and I think she probably thought, oh, Lord, not another war, because she'd gone through the war herself, you see. She'd been a nurse in Vimereux in France, and I think she was quite aware that I was obviously getting involved with this, and I know she was dead against it. Anyway, Joe gave me the direction, so I'd already knew them, to go to behind Covent Garden to King Street, where the party had their headquarters. Their headquarters there at the time, and in the end of 36, the end of the year, I think there'd just been one of the early battles and so on, and I'd heard about some of our people had gone over, and they'd formed at that time the something column. What do they call themselves now? Named after a German communist.
Don't worry about that.
No, can't think of it for the minute. Anyway, I went and, rather funny, went up these dark stairs and stood in a passage, and I could have all these closed doors, and I could hear typewriters going, and every now and again a door would open, and somebody would come out and walk right past, and I said, excuse me, so took no notice, no, weren't going to be carried on, and I thought, oh, where the hell do I go now, you see? And finally I stopped the woman, and she was... not very forthcoming, sort of say, what do you want? And I said I wanted to, I understood they were taking recruits to go to Spain and so on. And at first she said, I don't know, don't know anything about that. So on, then said, oh, well, wait a minute. And she went to ask somebody, and suddenly came back, and I was taken right up to the top floor, where there was a room, and there was a man behind a table and so on. And there were two men sitting, there waiting. It was rather, as I felt at the time, it was rather like sort of waiting to go to see the dentist. And another person came and joined, and that seemed to be the lot. They'd obviously, he was now he'd been writing, he looked up and said, "Well, what can I do for you?" sort of thing. And so we each said what we wanted to do, and it was all just to do the same thing. And he really wanted to know what you could do. And he said, "Are you quite serious? You realise this isn't the game. We've got to go there. We're going there to kill fascists, and they're going to try and kill you. And so, and you've got to be healthy because you're not going to get medical treatment and all this sort of thing. You're only going to be paid a few pesetas by the Spanish government, and you're attached to the Spanish army." And that's what we thought was at that time, that we were just going to go into the Republican army that was being formed, because the actual Spanish army had practically all opted to stay, to go under Franco, or rather they hadn't opted anything. Franco decided, and they and I suppose if you were on the wrong part of Spain, that where the higher ups had always engineered the uprising, the ordinary rank and file just had to go along with it. I mean, I know that was a fact later, because in talking to prisoners and people like that, I realised a lot of them had no options. Or where their families were, it often paid them to keep quiet. If they were under the government, under the Spanish socialist government, and you were in Franco's army, you didn't want them to know, because it could get quite nasty, so, and vice versa. Anyway, I was told details were taken, and I think the first interest was, I was asked if I was in the OTC, because none of the others had ever fired a gun or anything, and probably from the fact that my English hadn't sounded, it was fairly Cockney broad, I think most of the others were at the time, and they probably thought, "Oh, well, maybe he's been in OTC," but I said, "No, I haven't. All I'd ever been in were the Boy Scouts." And, the Spanish, that was the thing, yes. When he heard I spoke Spanish, then wanted to know, "Well, where did I learn it?" Got quite suspicious, I thought, at first. And I explained, and so on. And so I was told that to come back on the 2nd of January, after Christmas, after the night, that was 37. And so I went home, and from the word go, I began to sort of regret that I'd sort of stuck my neck out. I began to wonder whether I was it sensible? Still very vague as to what quite I was going to go to. But in the interim, there had been odd references in the press to the forming what I think was called a British column or something to be attached to the Spanish army. At that time, there wasn't, I don't think there was any references to anything called an international brigade. That seemed to come in a bit later. Anyway, on the 2nd of January, I went back to the same place in King Street, and there were some more had turned up or had subsequently joined or something, I don't know. But anyway, it was a little group of us there, and we were just checked over again, health, no obvious complaints and so on, and that was it. And
you
then
mean they just asked you about your health rather than
They didn't really do any check at all, not even about eyes. As a matter of fact, a bloke without a hand got through and wasn't found out until I think he got to Paris, where we had to go to the syndicalist group, communist trade union movement in Paris, which was a sort of recruiting station. Anyway,
and there he was sent back?
Yes, he would have been sent back from there. But they didn't discover him until then. Anyway, we were checked, and finally a woman, a communist comrade, though we didn't really know, very unprepossessing lady, was took us to Waterloo. Was it? I think, yes. And we were given, she bought tickets for us. No, she accompanied her, that's right. She bought the tickets, and we got on the train, and we went down to Dover. Yes, it was Dover. And crossed...
Excuse me, what did you take with you in the way of possessions and money?
I had a belt that had belonged to my father's, which I had put a few pounds of my own money, which I kept quiet about. Somebody had suggested it might be a good idea to have some money myself and not let it be known I had money, so that if it was necessary to try and come back or something. What I did, of course, was gradually change this, and probably got done in the eye over the exchange rates and so on, to get, first of all, some francs and then pesetas. But as far as our tickets were concerned, we were they were bought for us, and we were only just handed them when we had to go up onto the boat and we left. Now, it was all supposed to be secret. This was we weren't to draw attention to ourselves and so on. And you know, there was sort of a group of us were attaché cases, and some of our clothes were fairly worn and so on. I mean, the chaps I went with at that time, you know, were all working class lads from London, unemployed. I began to meet miners from South Wales and Scots from Scotland. All of them had strong reasons for, you know, and they weren't not communists. I mean, an awful lot of them were just labour people, socialists, but they felt very strongly about fascism spreading everywhere. And I suppose, you know, had been hearing the same sort of talk and propaganda that I had, and had volunteered. I was surprised that quite a number that were not communists, but it's difficult to tell, because a lot of card-carrying communists, except those that were picked out to be officers and NCOs, we finally realized were all party members, quite a lot in the rank and file, didn't publicly admit. You only knew when you heard that there was a party meeting, and they would go. The most vocal, we had a couple from the Young Communist League, East London Young Communist League, pain in the neck, because they were... I think they had a lot of funny ideas. They thought everything was to be put to a vote. They objected to showing, you know, taking any orders from anybody and so on, because we were a democratic socialist army, and so we won't salute officers, we won't do this and all the rest of it, which the official party line afterwards was quite, you know, came down on, because they realized it was affecting discipline, you know, military discipline. But at this stage, we crossed to France, went up we were met at I was vague about it, whether it was Folkestone or Dover, but I think it was actually Folkestone we went across to yes. Anyway, it was we took the train. We were picked up on the quayside by a French chap who spoke a little English. Led outside. We wondered how we were going to pass the gendarmes, so that they were standing around and so on, but nobody took any notice of us. We must have looked a funny little group going along with some with attaché cases. I had a rucksack on, some had brown paper parcel under the arm, as though we'd come over on a day trip to France. And train up to Paris, and we were met there, taken out, met again on the platform as we came out. They pretty obviously what we were, I think, and simply a chap came up in English and so on. And just took it as a matter of course. We were sort of marshalled together and taken out and put in taxis, and we were whisked off to north of the Seine.
Montmartre.
Yes, up towards there. It was the Communist Trade Union headquarters place, and they had a sort of hostel and various things like this. Anyway, we were all interviewed again. Details were taken, basically the same thing they'd done over in London. And we had to select a responsible, somebody was to be responsible for the party and so on. And we were taken out then in small groups with a Frenchman, obviously communists, but I just thought of him then as a sort of socialist, you know, person from just giving help. And we were taken to cafes that we were actually fed and entertained and treated very nicely. And some had been kept, they'd been there, they'd come over earlier, and they were there for 2 or 3 days, but were going to join our party. And we just happened to come on the day that they were going to move our group south. We didn't know how we would travel. We went down to the Gardem, what's the station south for the Mediterranean?
Gare du Lion?
No, I don't think so.
Doesn't matter anyway.
No, it doesn't matter anyway. It's south of the Seine, and that evening we went down there. We were very surprised to see quite a group of people there, and some banners put up, and all the rest of it. And so, having been told we had to be very secretive and all the rest of it, because the French officials mustn't know that we were passing through there, because there was a restriction and all this sort of thing, there didn't seem to be anything. And there were a lot of vivas going on, Viva España, Viva la Revolución, and all the rest of it. And several people came up and pontificated, which, of course, none of our lot would have understood a word of, I'm sure, because they couldn't speak French or Spanish. And then we had the night journey down to, I thought at first we were going down to Marseille, and somehow thought that it would be that way, and by boat. And but no, we went down to Papillon and arrived, I suppose, after an uncomfortable night. There was one little incident that I remember that first seemed a little odd. We were in this train, and soon after we left Paris, before we sort of actually settled down for the night, because we'd all been excited and hanging out of the window and all this sort of thing, and the lights flashing by, and a chap came in, pushed into the compartment. The compartments were in those old trains. They were sort of corridor on the side, rather like that we had here in this country, you know, where you got in and so you sat facing each other. And so we were all split into groups along there. And suddenly this bloke put out and called me Rubio. It's a name that as a kid, and my hair was very red, you know, standing up. And I was always known amongst the Spaniards or South America as Rubio, which is rather like ginger, you know, or carrots. It's a sort of, not, it's not a rude term on the whole. And he sort of put it, ah, Rubio, he said, you have a lot of Espanol. And somebody must have told him, you see, that I spoke Spanish. Well, he was a Frenchman, and but he spoke Spanish. And he started talking, and then left and went away. And by the way, I had met Joe Beckett. He didn't travel with us, but he was already in Spain when I got there. That was the first thing that struck me as a little strange. But the other chap, Bob Ivy, that I thought was coming over, didn't. Never turned up. And I discovered afterwards, yes, that he was a party member as well. But only Joe came, and he was already in the syndicalist place in Paris when we arrived there, and he travelled with us. And another old soldier, First World War soldier, who obviously also was a party member, Bob White, what's his first name? Can't, a very nice man. And Joe said, what was he on about? Okay. I said, oh no, he wanted to know, you know, where we came from and what we're doing. And he said, oh, yeah. He said, well, he said, I wouldn't answer too many questions. We don't know who he is, you see. Well, the following morning, the same bloke came up the corridor and once again came in and obviously wanted to